Today's episode of The Thriller Zone is sponsored by Blackstone Publishing and the brilliant new techno thriller 4 Minutes by the number one internationally best-selling author duo, Brian Andrews and Jeff Wilson. 4 Minutes is available now from your favorite bookseller. Hello and welcome to The Thriller Zone. I'm your host, David Temple. On today's 174th episode of The Thriller Zone podcast, we welcome number one New York Times bestselling author, Lisa Gardner, where, among other things, she'll discuss her illustrious career as a thriller writer and the inspiration behind her new book, Still See You Everywhere. As you very well know, this is your front row seat to the best thriller writers in the world. So without any further ado, let's sit down and talk with Lisa Gardner right here on The Thriller Zone.
I have a cold, unfortunately, but I'm armed here with tea and we can make this happen.
Excellent. Well, welcome to The Thriller Zone.
Thank you.
I am on location in hot, sticky, humid Miami.
Oh.
Yeah, so I'm not in my standard studio where I've got my big double monitors and all the lights and camera in action. So I'm just hoping you can see and hear perfectly.
How's spring break going there? Aren't they trying to corral it now?
We were talking about this over dinner last night, that they're really trying to discourage it because it's gotten completely out of hand.
Yes.
You remember back in the day when spring break meant you were staying out past curfew or you maybe got caught having a six pack, and now people are shooting each other.
Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, there's just too many people down there too. Like, it's just out of control.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just too much. That's too big of a scene right there.
Too many people. Yeah. Not the best recipe. Well, we're going to get to this fabulous book, Still See You Everywhere, which was a heck of a read. We're going to get to that. But I want to back up a little bit because, first of all, I have watched your career from afar. I've seen you on stage at conventions. I've certainly followed your career as far as books and so forth. But I'm really honored to have you on the podcast because I've been wanting to have you on for quite some time and the planets have aligned. So thank you.
Yeah. I'm excited to be here.
I want to ask you this because this is interesting. I did not know this. Probably a lot of my listeners will know this, that you started out writing romance suspense, which in one sense, as I was thinking about it, in one sense, it's not terribly different than thrillers because a lot of thrillers have an element of romance in it. But can you, just so I have a better idea, it's kind of a two-part question. First of all, I'd like to know why you decided to leave romance, which may or may not be an obvious question. And how do you compare writing romance suspense to classic full-on thriller writing like this one?
So back in the 1990s, there's actually a whole bunch of us that did this, basically this exact same career path. From Tess Gerritsen to Sandra Brown, Nora Roberts, Ios Johansson. We had all started out writing what we called back then like genre romantic suspense. The issue when you start out writing romantic suspense, or the advantage of it, is the character is the most important plot. So if you think of it as a spectrum, in a romantic suspense, the character's first, the plot is secondary. It's actually good training. And I still, to this day, am a character-driven writer. But I think there's this evolution. As you get more and more comfortable writing and you have more complicated ideas, that you start coming up with some plots now that they don't fall within that convention. So what a bunch of us really did is we ended up making the leap to mainstream thrillers, and most of us encountered, you know, pretty great success. And I think it's because we could take that thriller formula of the great plot twists and the exciting endings, but we really populated those books with the kind of characters that drew you in and that were compelling and felt like people you knew. And because that's somewhat like our background and training. That's kind of the camp we come from.
That makes so much sense because you're right. We all fall in love with the characters first and we think about the plot second. And as I was reading this book, I thought, now that you're saying that, it makes so much sense because I'm instantly falling in love with your protagonist, Frankie. Yeah. And I'm like, she's so bigger than life. And yet she's what's interesting. And I want to try to stay on topic is that she is she's broken. She's chipped. She's marred at the edges. but she's this heroine that you just go, oh, I want her on in my corner.
Frankie's very human, and it makes her really compelling. I mean, I've been at this a long time now. I mean, 30 years. And when I first started out on the thrillers, it was, you know, the standard FBI profiler, then, you know, the detective Dee Dee Warren in Boston. And those were all great characters too. But I think the appeal of Frankie for me is she's not any of those things. She's not badass. She's not kick-ass. I mean, she's just us. And it's that humanity that makes her very vulnerable. But it also makes her really effective. At the end of the day, people find themselves talking to her and telling her things that they probably wouldn't have shared with the police or authority or other outsiders. But again, that humanity for Frankie's always a double-edged sword. She does take the hits. She feels the blow. She can't just compartmentalize and wall it all off again. It's not, she's not truly a professional, you know?
Well, and you know what was so interesting, Lisa, that's why I found myself drawn to her, because I automatically, and I hope this is not, it's not giving too much away, and it's not a negative at all, but I was like, oh, it's kind of cool that she's not a detective or a PI or this or that. She is, as you said, just one of us going through life. And what was interesting, I'm like, she's doing this for the love of the game because she wants to help people. And I kept going, well, how does she get paid? I mean, how does this business model work?
Yeah. So Frankie was actually modeled off of someone I read about in real life.
Okay.
A person, Lisa Yellowbird Chase, who was frustrated by the number of women that were going missing on tribal lands that no one was even looking for. And you're right. I mean, the central question becomes, why would you do something like this? Devote your entire life to helping people you've never even met and have no home, no job, no anchor. I mean, I can't speak for the real life person. In Frankie's case, I think it's what's made her fun to write, in that I don't know that we have the answer to that question yet. I don't know that she knows the answer to that question. One of the driving factors for her working these missing persons cold cases is she's an alcoholic. And when she immerses herself in other people's problems and has a very goal-oriented agenda, it keeps her from drinking. She just sits around and thinks about herself, you know, to the bar she goes. So, but, you know, is she just a dry drunk then? Or is there more to this? I mean, I think she's still trying to figure that out.
Yeah, there's a line in there, and I'm going to massacre, so forgive me in advance. But someone is asking her, as she's going undercover to work in this bar, well, you're an alcoholic and you're going to work in a bar. Won't that be a temptation for you? And she said something to the effect of, no, breathing is the temptation for me.
And it's interesting because for some alcoholics, they can't be around it. And I have other friends and stuff who they can. They're like, and almost more sadly, I mean, the temptation is everywhere. So it doesn't really matter. It's like waking up in the morning. That's my temptation. So.
And again, you know, it's funny. When I was reading her, I thought, and I hope this is a good comparison because he's become one of my favorite and many of my listeners' favorite characters, is there's a little Jack Reacher, this lone survivor out there just going through life. Can I just get my toothbrush or my jacket on my back and go through life? And then they fall into this situation where they can help someone. And I thought, what a cool idea. It's like, she is completely her own. So I'm not saying, but it feels like a little bit of a female Jack Reacher.
And I always appreciate that comparison because I'm a huge Lee Child fan. I mean, one of the things Lee Child said about Reacher early on as a character, and I think it speaks to Frankie, is that, you know, in the beginning of civilization, there were people who sat around the campfire and there were people who had to get up and go. Reacher is one of the ones that has to get up and go. Well, you know, a lot of those pioneers had wives. You know, Frankie's one that has to get up and go as well. It's just that they don't do well being settled. And one of the things I think is compelling about Frankie is we're so socialized these days. I mean, the planet has 8 billion people and we're surrounded by images. This is what life is supposed to look like. This is the kind of job you should have, the car you should drive, the life you should lead. And for Frankie, none of that resonates for her. So she's already constantly feeling like an outsider because all the things she's being told she should want, she doesn't. Those are actually all the things that start making her dress and want to drink. So again, they're you know, kind of those lone wolf personalities, though, I mean, Frankie's social in her own way, but she's just not meant to stay in one place. She's not meant for the conventional life. That's just never going to be her.
Yeah. Well, I love it. I want to read, check this out, folks. I want to read something that's on the inside of the jacket. And it says, if this doesn't get your attention, I'm really not sure what will. A dozen strangers, countless dangerous secrets, zero means of calling for help. And then the storm rolls in. And it does. The prologue begins with what I feel like is kind of it's a journal of sorts. And then it launches into chapter one with this opening line that grabs you by the throat and says, okay, you ready for a ride? Because we are. And I want to, as we talk about this protagonist that you so deftly created, so she came from a real person. Do you, and this is slightly cliche, because we're all, as writers, we're all doing a little bit of therapy, aren't we, Lisa?
Yeah.
But are there little fragments of you, or either the broken pieces, or are there pieces you're like, man, I want to be that brave soul that does something just for the good of it?
You know, it's funny, when I was writing Detective Dede Warren, people like, so is that you? And I'm like, oh, dear God, no, that's like my alter ego. That's the woman who can do everything and say everything I would never say. But Frankie is probably the of any character I've written, the closest to me, in that she's an everyday average person. She doesn't have any superpowers. She's smart. She's adaptable, and she likes to travel. And I have to admit, I love to travel. One of the big inspirations behind Still See You Everywhere is I had the opportunity to go to a remote atoll in the Pacific where there were 12 strangers. And yes, there was a storm that rolled in and our plane did not make it to take us back out. And that was also the plane with the food. So it was a little concerning at the time.
Did you take off, was it 22 or 23 you took off an entire year, just kind of got off the writing grid and said, this is all for me?
Yes, in 2022, I think it was. Yeah, I took a sabbatical. It'd been 30 years of deadlines, and I just wanted. And it was so funny because my agent and my editor said, "You're so institutionalized, you'll totally have a book by the end of this." And I'm like, "I will not. I'm going to go on vacation. You cannot make me write a book." And yeah, sure enough, you know, my first trip was Antarctica. The second one was Palmyra, which is on the equator in this rainforest environment Frankie's talking about. And yeah, it's remote, it's barren. And when we arrive, they're like, you know, they really prefer it if you don't have an appendix, because medical evac is going to be 3 to 5 days away. There's all sorts of rules governing behavior, because little things become big things very quickly. And as a thriller writer, I'm sitting there and I'm, you know, soaked through, because it's so damn humid. It's just ungodly humid. And we all liked each other till about day two. And then we all hated each other because we hadn't, because it was so damn humid. And I was like, oh my God, this is the perfect locked room mystery. Because there's just no way on, there's no way off. Like, things go bad here. I called it, my other term I use, it's the summer camp version of The Shining. You're there. Yes.
That's so, good.
I took a sabbatical, and yeah, I kind of came up with a novel. They might be right. I might be institutionalized at this point.
It's funny, Lisa, because you have done something that I think we don't do enough of. And when I say the collective we, it can be us authors, it can be any walk of life you're in. But I think we don't, especially the onslaught of media and social media always slamming against our brains. I go, we need more time to just be and to just chill and allow quiet to roll in. Don't you agree?
Yeah. You know, several of my trips I did were off the grid. Palmyra was the most off the grid. And it's funny, because compared to some of my peer group, I'm not even the biggest cell phone addict. And I got twitchy. You just, to not know what's going on, to not have communication with the outside world, and day after day after day. Yeah, it was, and we all got twitchy.
Twitchy is a good word. You know, let's assume something. Let's assume that someone is tuning in and meeting you for the first time. How would you describe Still See You Everywhere? And I mean it on its, not, well, there's a part of me that wants the elevator pitch, but there's a part of me that wants to know, how would you describe this story in and of itself?
So Frankie Elkin is an everyday average person. She's obsessed with finding missing persons the world has forgotten. In this particular case, which is her weirdest one, to be sure, she is summoned to a maximum security prison by a serial killer who's going to death, executed, and unrepentant, doesn't care. Yeah, nope, she totally killed them all, and it was a great deal of fun to speak of it. You can learn about the care feeding of pigs also in this novel. But her sister, baby sister, was kidnapped 15 years ago. She just got evidence she might still be alive, and she just wants someone to find her sister and to know she's safe before she goes to her death. And Frankie doesn't really care much for the beautiful butcher, but the opportunity to try to bring a young girl home from Hawaii that might have been human trafficked, seems to have been kidnapped by a wealthy billionaire, is too good of an opportunity to pass up. And that brings her to a remote atoll, and then, no means of rescue, no hope of escape, and bad things happen from there. Murder and mayhem ensue. Isn't that all of it? Murder and mayhem ensue.
We'll be right back. Stay with us. Today's episode is sponsored by Blackstone Publishing and the new thriller 4 Minutes by the best-selling authors of the Sons of Valor series, Brian Andrews and Jeff Wilson. When Special Ops Chief Tyler Brooks is recruited to lead an elite new squad to face an unpredictable enemy, he's promised access to mind-bending technology, the ability to glimpse into the future, collecting intel to stop attacks in the present. But when a plot to attack America, threatening the lives of millions, is discovered, is 4 minutes enough time to change the outcome? This new techno thriller will have you on the edge of your seat until the very last page. 4 minutes is available now from your favorite bookseller. And now, back to the show.
Here's something it forced me to think, and there are not a lot of stories that you read on any daily basis about a female serial killer. I know there have been some. Yep. There have been some famous ones. I think of the one that was enacted by Charlize Theron back several years back.
Yeah,
but monster. It is monster. It's not really that common, which is why, as I'm reading it, I'm like, wow, it was so, and I hate to use, I'm going to sound like I'm glorifying butchery and murder, but it's the way that there's this confidence. She's beautiful. She's confident. She's like, yeah, whatever. I did it because they had it coming to them, and I enjoyed every bit of it. I want to drill down for just a second about that theory of not a lot of female serial killers.
Yeah. You know, when I first started out, I was writing FBI profiler books, and one of the things I loved about them was the psychology of crime. And early on, someone, a profiler, explained to me, you see many more male serial killers than female because men historically externalize their pain and their rage. They will lash out. They will create a proxy or surrogate victim for, you know, to target with their emotions. Women have a tendency to internalize it. So the cycle of violence for women will lead more to alcoholism, suicide, eating disorders, those kinds of things. Interestingly enough, well, and then the female serial killers we've seen then have been externally motivated, like for money. So it's not been that same psychology at all. It's like arsenic and old lace. But it's been fun to read now as we are, you know, equalizing gender roles. And as we are telling women it's more comfortable to have all of these emotions, we are seeing an uptick in violent women. So see, equality at work, you know, here. And when I did a book a few years ago, people like the police I was interviewing at the time, like, oh my God, the female gangbangers are the worst. I mean, they're 20 times more violent and more likely to take a small offense and, you know, blast away at it. And I was like, interesting. Okay, this is kind of fun, but yes.
Do you find and I'm going to drill on your psyche now. Do you find yourself, as you were creating this character, do you find yourself going, yeah, I mean, the fantasy is, yeah, you know, that person really pissed me off. I'd like to get back at him, even in a tiniest little way.
You know, what I saw in The Beautiful Butcher was her pain. Just like this deep, deep, dark well of despair that she didn't know how to deal with. And she was wired for violence because of their own abusive father. And so that's what she fell back on, was her wiring. And I think when you emphasize the pain, it makes her a little bit more relatable as a person. You don't necessarily think, well, no, that, you know, murdering 18 men was a good thing. But, you know, she really did have it rough. It was a tough life, you know.
and I have to say this, and I hope she doesn't. I'm visiting my wife and I are visiting her parents. So my mother-in-law and my wife and I are sitting around this morning having breakfast. And I had just described this book. My wife asked Tammy, said, how are you liking the book? I'm like, I'm loving it. You can tell this woman can flat out write. I'm like, oh my God. And she's like, well, tell me what it is. And I explained the whole thing, like from the, in a very capsulized form. And then my mother-in-law walks up and Tammy says, well, you got to tell Mom what this book is about. And I describe, you know, these two gals, bad situation, violent father, alcohol, et cetera. And my mother-in-law turns to me and says, oh, is that my autobiography?
Oh my gosh, poor thing.
sad, but true. But yeah. It's always interesting to see when people come to a story, they go, oh, there's a whole lot of me in that.
Yeah.
So going to that opening flashback, and which was horrifying, there's a certain style about your work that I really like. And I'll admit that I'm new to the party. But if someone were to ask me, David, what do you like about Lisa's style? I'm like, you know, it's elevated in that it's rapid fire, but not rushed, which I love the beginning of it. It's just like, there's no time to catch your breath. It's in depth without getting lost in the weeds. But my favorite part is how you weave this, what I'm going to call inside of your head voice in with the dialogue. Such craftsmanship.
I consider most of my books kind of a deep narrative drive. Like, I want you in the mind of the character. I don't like telling. I'd like to show you what's going on and let you figure it out for yourself. And I'd like you to feel what the characters are feeling. It's a very intimate relationship with the character.
Well, and you just said it right there. What's the one thing you learn in any kind of a writing class? Show, don't tell.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think, when I very first heard that, I had, and do me a favor, Lisa, I had the hardest time understanding the difference. Well, what do you mean? Well, I am showing you. I'm not telling you. Yeah. If you were to describe this to a classroom right now, how would you best describe that technique?
You need to trust the reader. You need to set a scene and then don't explain what just happened. Just set the scene, let the scene unfold, and trust that the reader is going to walk away with what they needed to know. And you can use, actually, one of my favorite examples when I do workshops for show, not tell, is way back in the day, again, FBI profile research. They talked about, there's an FBI agent who grew up really, really super poor, like so poor, he never got to eat candy, but he and his brother would sometimes, you know, find candy wrappers and chew on them, you know, because for the sugar that was still in it. And then, you know, fast forward decades later, he's now really successful. And what he's discovered is can't eat candy. He still prefers the wrapper. I mean, that kind of just little detail that tells you so strongly just where he comes from and the way that we can't escape our past, the way it shapes us irrevocably. So those little things like that, to me, that show, don't tell. You can say, oh, he was poor once and he's successful now, but it still haunts him. That's telling you. Or you can talk about, you know, the guy chewing on a Snickers wrapper.
That is so good. And that's so powerful. So thank you for that. As I was wrapping the book, and folks, it has one of these crescendo conclusions that it's gonna haunt me for a while. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with the haunting. But I caught myself asking, and I said, be sure, and I made a note, be sure to ask Lisa this. How many books had you written until you said, hey, I'm really good at this?
I don't think any author ever thinks that or says that. It feels like we're banging a head against a wall each and every time. I mean, I think one of the biggest things I had to come to terms with as a novelist is that it doesn't get easy, and it's not supposed to get easy. Each book is its own world, and you're starting from scratch creating it, and creation's never easy. But I really kept thinking there should be a day where it's like, oh, I just sit down and I rip out a novel because I am so good at this. And no, really, if that day ever happens, though, I'm going to call you first, David.
Okay. And I think, you know what I think it is? It's I'm starting to hear this. We're coming up on 3 years with this podcast now, so approaching 200 episodes, and Thank you. Thank you. I'm always surprised at how many times authors say the same thing you just said. Oh, I feel like a phony. I'm afraid somebody's going to find me out. Oh, you got to be kidding me. I'd never feel good at this, which is a surprise. However, let's drill down one tiny little extra level. There has to be something and on a confidence level that you can say, you know, Lisa, golly darn it, I'm good at this. Because I'm just curious to know what's the part of your craftsmanship and your talent, which is immense, 30 plus, that says that you know, well, this right here, I'm really particularly good at. And I think what I'm trying to get at is, what are you most proud of, where you really feel the most confident?
You know, character for me remains to this day organic. I can see them, I can picture them, I can hear them in my head. People want me to do characterization workshops because I'm known for my characters. And I'm like, it's just organic for me. The plot I work on, the research I work on. I love dialogue because to me, that's just picturing multiple characters in my head having a conversation. So those scenes for me and action scenes go really fast. I really struggle with description. I think I'm not terribly a visual person myself. So it's funny. I mean, I can blaze through all this, you know, death and destruction and action sequences. And then, you know, I have to describe the tablecloth. And it's like, God damn it, we're going to be here a bit. I figure this out.
It is true, though. Your dialogue I remember back in the day when we would read a book and the description could go on for paragraphs, even pages. And I'm like, come on, get the people talking. And nowadays, the guys and gals like yourself who really have mastered that, I find myself going, I can't get enough dialogue because it feels like I'm sitting there watching a movie or eavesdropping on a conversation, especially when you have that, again, that little inside your head voice mixed in with the dialogue.
No, it was the real challenge for Still See You Everywhere, because the atoll that was the inspiration for the book, and the book we call it Pomakai, but in the real world, it's Palmyra. It's such a surreal, separate universe. I mean, it's this so remote. The, you know, heat and humidity are unreal. The wildlife that's there and crabs, they said they'd be crabs, but I had no idea, like, oh God, there were crabs. There were so many crabs and some kinds of crabs, and the crabs were the food chain, and some of the crabs were cannibals to other crabs. And in the middle of the night, that place was hopping in a really terrifying way. And those are things I want to describe for the reader. And yet that is my weakness. So sometimes it took me like 5 pages to figure out these were the 5 sentences for Frankie to set the scene for you so that you could see where you were. Because what an extraordinary place, but also kind of terrifying as well and uncomfortable. If people are used to civilization, those kinds of conditions, you know, no plumbing, no electricity, those kinds of stuff, it's rustic.
Yeah. Getting outside the comfort zone gives you an elevated experience. Doesn't it? Yeah. You know, having come from a background in radio and TV and film, I have to ask, how has your experience been with working with Hollywood? Because so much of your work has been adapted, especially as it comes to that adaptation of the books. How do you like that arena of Hollywood? How do you like being around it, playing in it? Has it been a friend of yours?
I've had 4 things adapted, and it's been very bizarre. Like, 1, I would say not very good. 1, I would say very good, and 2, kind of in between. I think as a novelist, you know, if people want to know your work, they should read the book. But the minute you sell it to Hollywood, it becomes a director's vision, you know, and your character becomes an actor's vision. So you just have to let go. You have to let them do their job now and kind of just enjoy the ride. I mean, think of your work more as the inspiration behind what came next versus a direct representation for what's coming next.
I think Mark Graney has been, I think he just had his 4th appearance on the show. I can't believe in 3 years.
He's such a good guy.
There's just few nicer. And he put it best. We were talking about, Mark, how does it feel to... Yeah. Have your book and then you see it on screen. He goes, you know what? It's cool. It's definitely cool to hear the words come out of an actor's mouth. Yeah. He goes, but I got used to, and I love this. He said, early on, I had to know that, and you just kind of referred to this, I created what I created, and it was exactly what I wanted to create. So that when I handed it off, or sold it in this case, sold it, I had to be okay with the fact that someone else was going to take it and make it their own. And he goes, the minute I said, that's fine with me, I was good with it. And I think that's such a healthy way to look at it.
Yeah. If you want direct control, you know, you're going to have to keep it to yourself or wait till you're so big you can. But I don't know. I also think I'm really good at writing, but I don't know how to do screenplay. I don't know how to shoot film. I'm not that visual. So, you know, let those experts do their thing. It is fun. Carla Gugino played Detective Dee Dee Warren, and she's a really renowned character actress. And meeting with her, getting to see her interpretation of Dee Dee was really fun, because to me, she caught the spirit of the character really nicely, kind of Dee Dee's edginess and, you know, kind of almost raw workaholic spirit and semi-feral behavior. So it was a lot of fun to watch her at work. And I mean, and that was pretty wild.
And give me that, because I'm going to go back and watch this, because she's such a fantastic
Hyde
actress.
It was, yeah, the movie adaptation of Hyde. It was on TNT a few years ago. They did a bunch of books. I'm like staring at the movie poster now, because that will clearly help you.
Awesome. As begin to wrap, because I know you got a huge, I mean, you're right in the middle of the thick of your marketing and advertising and tour and so forth. I've got just a couple of quick things. The first is, what do you hope that readers will take away from this thriller? And not only just take away from this particular book, but take away from you and this experience?
Oh, I mean, my goal is always to entertain. So I want people to, you know, stay up way too late, not feed their kids, miss their bus stop, you know, nice, you know, very nice goals like that. Frankie's mission is real, and there are real Frankies out there. We have hundreds of thousands of missing people at any given time. So many of them are kids, and a handful gain national attention. And I do think it's, you know, so many of these people, they weren't seen in life, and they're not seen after they're gone. I think that's just a horrible injustice, especially for us, not even as a country, but as neighbors, as people. We should see each other.
That's so good. And that is, well, still see you everywhere. My final question, and it's something I close all my shows with, it's a standard closer. What's your best writing advice? Now, this is going to be especially to those who would like to make a career of this, much like yourself. So if you had to sum it up in, what is that best writing advice?
Oh, wait, so I'll give you something tangible and a little goofy, but it actually does work. So particularly in the beginning of my career, because it took, you know, 10 years to become an overnight success, like most aspiring writers out there, I wrote for a couple hours a day, and I was in school for a bit. I had a real job for a bit. I had two jobs for a bit and was writing 2 hours a day. So you have kids, you have all these other things going on, and you're trying to snag this writing time. And half the battle is just how to switch gears, how to even focus and get to thinking about the book. And there was another romantic suspense author, Suze Brockman, that talked about the power of scent. It's a major trigger. So every time you write, you have the same lit candle, we'll say vanilla. Then at a certain point in the process, the scent of vanilla will make you want to write. And it is a genuine trigger. It is a conditioned response. We're going straight. So each book has had its own scented candle. But do pick a scent you like, because for it to work, you have to keep doing it. So,
yeah. Oh my gosh. So it's almost Pavlovian.
Yeah, that's it. That's the whole point. And scent is one of the fastest ways of triggering a Pavlovian response. I think it was Michael Crichton, I want to say, who had this whole thing where he ate the same lunch when he was writing a book, because he didn't want to ruin his creative process trying to think of what to eat for lunch. And, you know, it kind of almost became part of the book. So, you know, he identified each of his novels by the sandwich. So weirdly enough, these little ticks can be helpful, because in the beginning, it's very difficult to carve out the time to do this and to get the mindset to do this, particularly with our cell phones buzzing and email flashing and all of that kind of stuff. But
Well, it is so refreshing to run across someone who has given me a piece of advice that I have never heard before.
You know, it was so helpful. I loved it. It was like, it was every now and then at conferences, I'm like, can we do something on creativity or how to like get in the mindset? Because these little things can make a big difference.
Well, and you can be sure that I'll be using the hashtag scented candle when I go to publish this.
There we go. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, folks, once again, the book is Still See You Everywhere. If you'd like to learn more, go to website lisagardner.com. Of course, follow her on social media as I do. And Lisa, once again, this has been a huge honor, and I hope to see you at one of the upcoming conventions. Thank you for this time.
Yeah. Thank you so much, David. It's been a pleasure.
Your front row seat to the best thrillers. The Thriller Zone.
The Thriller Zone has been presented by Blackstone Publishing and the exciting new techno thriller 4 Minutes, now available from your favorite bookseller. Learn more at blackstonepublishing.com.